Slate. This is the Michael Slate Show, and welcome back to the Michael Slate Show, because I'm sure as hell glad to be here, all right? I'm Michael Slate, and you're not, but you know what? You're the whole reason why we can continue to exist the way we are, all right? But at the back end of the show, we're going to hear from Sansara Taylor from Rise Up for Abortion Rights, talking about the abortion rights emergency and the call for nationwide protests beginning March 8th. And at the beginning of the show, we'll be speaking with Robert Jensen. Now, Robert's an emeritus professor in the School of Journalism and Media at the University of Texas at Austin, and is a founding board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center. He is a prolific writer on many subjects, including ecology, economic justice, racism, and religion. He's been studying pornography and its impact on women and men since 1988. And he's written three books and many articles about it. And that's what we'll be talking about today. All right. All right. Now, I'm really pleased to jump into this part of the show. Okay. On December 13th, the musical artist Billie Eilish appeared on the Howard Stern Show and said, "As a woman, I think porn is a disgrace. And I used to watch a lot of porn, to be honest. I started watching porn when I was like 11. I didn't understand why that was a bad thing. I thought that somehow that was how you learned to have sex." She also noted that when she later had sex, she said, "I was not saying no to things that were not good. And it's because I thought that's what I was supposed to do. That's what I was supposed to be attracted to. I'm so angry that porn is so loved, and I'm so angry at myself for thinking that it was okay." Now, think about the heaviness of that, all right? And her remarks caused a lot of controversy, including some very cowardly attacks on her mother and father. We're going to dig into these questions that she raised with our first guest, Robert Jensen. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
All right. Now, I'm going to take some of the things that you know, you were Billie Eilish, you know, and I'm going to take some of the things that Billie Eilish said in her interview with you, because I think they covered a lot of the questions surrounding pornography. First, she said that she thought pornography was a form of sex education. She's not alone. So let's jump into this, because I know this, you know, when you know, people, young people, old people, a lot of old people who have no idea really what the essence of all this is. So what is porn and why is it not sex education? Or as you put it in an article, why is pornography doing the worst to women and bringing out the worst in men?
Right. Well, we know that in the United States, there's a lack of healthy sex education, whether it's coming from parents or the schools or churches. Unfortunately, young people don't get the kind of information that they need. And so, of course, that doesn't mean they don't think about or get curious about sex. So where do they turn? Well, they turn to the steady stream of sexually explicit material that's on the Internet. And that is not a healthy sex education. It's a form of a kind of pathological sex education. Because as the feminist anti-pornography movement has been pointing out for now about a half a century, pornography is not just sex on film. It's not just a depiction of the ways people typically have sex. It's the presentation of sex in the context of domination and subordination. It's a relentlessly sexist, misogynist form. It's also, by the way, relentlessly racist. It's a kind of presentation of sex that eroticizes any form of domination that exists in our world today. Well, if you have, as Billie Eilish said, starting at 11, and that's not unusual. I hear from people all the time who say, "I started watching porn when I was 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. If especially a young boy's first exposure to porn is in high school, they're usually late to the game. Okay. So that's the situation we have in the United States today. We have increasingly younger people accessing easily online graphic, sexually explicit material that is deeply misogynistic and deeply racist. And it's hard to imagine how anything good comes out of that situation.
Yeah, you know, it's exactly, you know, and it's sort of this thing of the way that it's always sort of like, it's minimized, you know, like sort of like you don't really, it's not really all that bad. It's not really all this. And you know, and it's something that, I mean, you see it with kids. You see it from when kids first begin to think that, okay, there's a way to run around in the world. And a lot of this comes into people's, basically their thinking, just on the basis of what has been put out to them time and time again. And another thing that, you know, that you've mentioned is that this artist, you know, you mentioned about her, that she started to view increasingly extreme and violent pornography, even as there was all this stuff about, well, what is it? It's, you know, it's like, it's just kids having, you know, having fun. It's just people watching those. But she actually saw an increasingly extreme and violent pornography. And this sounds like a contradiction, but the porn is becoming, the pornography that she was involved in is becoming more extreme and at the same time more mainstream. Let's talk about that.
Well, that's the what I've called the paradox of pornography. How can a media genre become more mainstream, more acceptable, more viewed, at the same time that it becomes more intensely cruel and degrading to women and more intensely racist? The paradox is an unpleasant one to consider because it tells us something about the nature of the culture we live in. But you made an important point that people want to minimize this. They'll say, well, that's just kids exploring. It's just bodies. But as we're pointing out, the content of a good percentage of the online pornography is graphic and sexually explicit, but also cruel, degrading, racist, all that stuff. So it's not just, you know, quote-unquote normal sex. Now, one of the ways people minimize this is to caricature the feminist critique by saying, oh, well, you think porn causes rape. And that has never been the argument, that there's some direct cause where, you know, person watches pornographic film, person engages in rape. You know, media consumption and the way we understand how images work is far too complex for that kind of simplistic assessment, which the feminist movement never made. What we're talking about is how a steady exposure to these kinds of images cultivates a certain attitude. It doesn't mean everybody who watches porn behaves the same, but we know that about all media. You know, everybody who sees a television commercial doesn't robotically go out and buy the product, but it does have an effect on how we come to see the world, and how we see the world has an effect on how we behave in the world. And so the importance of not minimizing this is really crucial because, and here I'll be critical of the left, which I'm a part of, you know, I think, unfortunately, too often in the liberal left side of the political fence, people have minimized and often ignored the increasing evidence of the consequences of this kind of pornography.
Yeah, you know, I want to hit this again, too, though, because, you know, when we're talking about the, you know, and look, for a lot of people, you know, when you're talking about this, another thing that the artist mentioned is that, as I was saying, that she started to view increasingly extreme and violent pornography, and that this sounds like a contradiction, but the porn is becoming more extreme and at the same time more mainstream. This is a very heavy, very heavy statement in terms of the society and what it's being, what is basically coming out as the okay thing to do, you know, and this is something that really, I think, has to be spoken to pretty hard.
Right. You know, I often think about the woman who's most responsible, I think, for us understanding much of this, Andrea Dworkin. The pornography she analyzed in the late 1970s, let's say, and 80s, compared to the pornography today, is extraordinarily tame. I mean, she saw that domination-subordination dynamic, the eroticizing of male power, the eroticizing of racism. She saw it, she wrote about it, as did other women, you know, going back decades. But I think Andrea, who sadly died in 2005, would not have been able to predict the intensity of contemporary pornography. And again, you know, we're talking about things that are hard to describe on the air, given FCC regulations. But as I said before, what they're about is sexualizing inequality, the fundamental inequality in straight porn, the porn that's marketed to the heterosexual audience, is, of course, male over female. But the interesting thing about pornography is it eroticizes every inequality, as I said. Race is one. Class is another. Status in society. There's even pornography using women with disabilities. I mean, if you can imagine it, it has been made into porn, I think. Now, again, that's not sex education in any healthy or sensible way. It's not just, you know, curiosity being fed. It's the systematic presentation of women as objectified female bodies for male sexual pleasure. And that is contrary to any, I think, program of liberation, any left politics, any serious attempt to create gender justice in society.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that actually is, and again, it's, this is sort of going to be a little bit backing up, but I think it's really, there's an element here that a lot of people just sort of just push away, mm-hmm. that they don't really think about. And when you talk about this in terms of, you know, this thing that the artist mentioned is that she started to view increasingly extreme and violent pornography. Right. This sounds like a contradiction, but the porn is becoming more extreme and at the same time, more mainstream. You know, you think about that. Right. This is a very heavy statement. This is a big, yeah. big thing, I think, that we have to speak to.
Yeah, and you know, this is not unique only to pornography. Think about the controversy over YouTube videos and the way the algorithms of YouTube point people toward more extreme racist content, for instance. We know how these platforms operate, and they operate exactly in the same way as pornography. I've talked to a lot of men. My focus has been on the men who consume pornography and how it changes their attitudes and their behavior. And one of the things that I've heard consistently, and this goes back decades now, is men will say, you know, I was curious. I didn't really know what I was looking for. I got online. I saw, you know, what you might call, quote unquote, straight porn, you know, that is by contemporary terms rather tame. And they said, but, you know, that kind of whetted my appetite. And then I would see a more extreme video, and then I would see another more extreme video. And I've had men tell me, you know, I ended up in places I would have never imagined. And for some men, that has also included what we used to call child pornography, and we now call child sex abuse materials. Men who aren't pedophiles in any traditional sense of the term psychologically would find themselves increasingly attracted to pornography that used either actual children or adult women who are, you know, portrayed in childlike manners. Well, all of this is pretty routine these days. I hate to say it, but you can hear these stories from many, many men. It's a kind of predictable consequence of where the pornography industry has taken it. But it is something we should be much more concerned about. You know, the left is, I think, appropriately aware that, you know, racist stereotypes in Hollywood movies or sexist images, you know, in cable television. But those are problems that should be addressed. They should be critiqued. Yet the left too often does not apply that same standard to pornography, and I think it's a real serious deficiency in current left approaches to media.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Robert Jensen, and we're talking about the hellified character of what's being done to women, children, men, to some, you know, whatever, but in terms of pornography. And I think it's extremely important for people to actually get what's going on. And I have to tell you that I think you have a very powerful, you know, when you're bringing this out, it just keeps hitting me how powerful what you're saying is. And there's a point about the left and uh-huh. in this country. And as the point is that the left often basically steps up and defends porn, you know, and yeah. it's a false dichotomy, but that if you are against porn, you are a prude. You have a right. problem with sex and eroticism. But actually, yeah. what's really going on here? Bring this out to people in terms of what yeah. the truth is.
Well, I think there is a legitimate discussion, and reasonable people can disagree about the legal strategies to address the question of pornography. And so when people on the left say, well, I reject censorship, that's perfectly fine. That debate can go forward. But too often, as you point out, people on the left not only are critiquing potential censorship, they're actually defending porn. In fact, there's a kind of portion of the feminist movement over the last 20 years or so that even celebrates pornography as a form of sexual liberation. Now, the porn industry is huge, so there's a lot of variation in pornography, but when I critique, as my feminist colleagues do, when we critique the porn industry, we're looking at the normal, quote-unquote, porn, the porn that is most common, the porn that most people, especially most men, watch. You can find lots of variation, but, you know, you can find lots of variation in everything. My friend Gail Dines, who's probably the leading feminist critic today, says, you know, if you wanted to understand capitalism, would you go to the few worker-owned cooperative businesses to understand capitalism? No, you wouldn't. They exist, but they're not representative of the driving force behind capitalism. And so we have to look at the pornography that is most common, that most men especially are using. And there you see these themes of increasing extreme cruelty and degradation, increasingly intense racism, as well as sexualizing all other inequalities. Now, it's hard to imagine anybody on the left endorsing that, but in fact they do. And I think there are lots of complex reasons. One is, let's not forget the personal. Pornography isn't an abstract question, right? There's a lot of people using pornography, including a lot of men on the left, and, you know, increasingly, unfortunately, even more women. So we're not just talking about an issue out there, you know, distant. We're talking about how all of us have been, you know, socialized to understand men, women, sex, gender, power, and it's hard to break away from that. So it's in a way, it's a very intimate debate for all of us because we all have to confront the way we've been trained. And my own, you know, journey on this starting, God, almost 35 years ago, reading radical feminist literature, it was a real wake-up call for me. It confronted me. I had to think, well, how have I been trained? You know, I thought I was a nice liberal guy, but all of a sudden I had to realize I'd been socialized into the same view of women, not only through pornography, but through the whole culture. And it's been difficult, painful. And so, you know, we have to step up and do this, even when it is not easy.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that actually I think is extremely important that Billie Eilish brought up, the impact on the actual sex lives of people. Uh-huh. This is not something that just exists in, like, you know, porn magazines, yeah, or movies, you know, sliding into some scurvy little place. Yeah. She felt pressured to do things that made her feel uncomfortable and really not enjoyable. I've heard of many other young women who say the same thing. What's real? What's the real world impact of this? And it's really important because, you know, it's not a matter of whether they're prudes or not prudes. It's not a whether, you know, the kind of, they're just that they don't get it or something. But there's an actual impact here that it's extremely important for people to understand.
Absolutely. And as we pointed out, it's not some, you know, a simplistic relationship between media and images and then behavior. But we are products of a highly mediated culture. And so I can tell you the things I've heard directly from people. I've heard from many young women who, and quite frankly, even older women who say they feel that it's their obligation, given the way they are often socialized in patriarchy, to, you know, perform sex acts that men want. And I've heard lots of men say the sex acts they want are conditioned by their use of pornography. The most extreme effect I've seen on men is, and this has been a story I've been hearing now for, you know, probably 20 years, increasingly common now, which is men who will say, my sexual imagination is so keyed to pornography. I started watching pornography when I was so young that I don't really know a non-pornographic sexuality. And they will tell me, as they have, that they can't have sex in the real world with a partner without imagining pornographic scenes. I've had one man told me it's like there's a porn loop running in my head constantly, and the only way I can even get an erection is to think about that. There are now more and more men who are reporting that they have what is now called porn-induced erectile dysfunction. Young men who are healthy and have no reason to be experiencing erectile dysfunction, find that they cannot perform sexually in the real world, and it's a direct result of the pornography. The flip side, of course, is how this affects women, and not only are women sometimes feeling they have to perform these sex acts, but there's coercion involved, too. When men are raised on a steady diet of this aggressive, misogynistic sex, they often come to believe that they have a right to it. And those stories are also common about men who think what they're demanding, what they've seen in porn, is normal, natural, and women should submit to it. So, again, we don't want to pretend that everybody has the same reaction to pornography, but these kind of reactions are common enough now that we can't dismiss them as idiosyncratic.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're coming close to the end of our session here, but there's something I really wanted to talk to you about. That, you know, finally, mm-hmm. you've published several books and many articles about pornography and its impact on women. You also write about many other important areas. How do people find your work?
Well, if people just put my name into a search engine, Robert Jensen, and if you spell it right, J-E-N-S-E-N, my page will be the first one that comes up. So rather than, you know, reading a URL, it's easy just to find me online. And I would suggest that people interested in exploring this question of pornography not only look at my work, but the feminist work. I mentioned Andrea Dworkin. Her work, you know, 30, 40 years later, is still as powerful as ever. My friend Gail Dines, who I mentioned, runs a group called Culture Reframed. And that's an attempt to look at the pornographic world we live in and provide resources to young people, to parents, on how to cope with it. You know, there's no putting the genie back in the bottle, as we say. Pornography is a part of everyday life, and we have to be willing to talk about it, including the uglier parts of it that we've been discussing so far, so that people don't sort of fear the conversation. This is something kids are dealing with everywhere, and we have to talk about it more openly and more honestly.
I think we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us. Any last comments?
Well, you know, sometimes people say to me, well, you know, there's a lot of problems in the world, climate change, nuclear war. It's all true, but we also see that all of this is about a world in which domination and subordination have become so naturalized and so common. And so, you know, we strike out against it where we see it, and one of the places we see it is pornography. It's not the only issue, not the most important issue in the world, but it's a place where we get a glimpse into how ugly this society can be, and I think instead of looking away, we have an obligation to look at it.
All right. I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and, you know, basically stay in touch, man, because you're doing a lot of very important work.
Well, thanks so much, Michael.
Thanks, man. Take care.
Okay.
Bye now. All right. This is the Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Robert Jensen, professor emeritus at the University of Texas, Austin, and a writer and activist. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right, or maybe not even a musical break, maybe a loud break, okay? And we'll be back right after that.
Special, you made me my fault. You were the devil, lost your appeal. Does it keep you in control? For you to keep her in a cage. And you swear you didn't know. You said you thought she was your age. How dare you? And how could you? Will you only feel bad if it turns out that they kill your contract? Would you try not to abuse your power? I know we didn't choose to change. You might not wanna lose your power, but power isn't pain.
That was Billie Eilish with Your Power. All right, now, before we talk with Sansara Taylor, I would really like to play a reading of a new statement by Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and author of The New Communism. This is The Fight for Abortion Rights and the Emancipation of Women, read by a member of the Revolution Club.
The Fight for Abortion Rights and the Emancipation of Women by Bob Avakian. The essential question at stake with the escalating attack on the right to abortion is the fundamental status of the half of humanity that is female, whether they will be enslaved or emancipated. Of course, in the case of the extremely small number of females who have transitioned or are transitioning to males, but who retain female reproductive organs and might get pregnant, they should have the right to abortion and to decent healthcare overall, without any stigma or discrimination. And in general, attacks directed against trans people must be actively, vigorously opposed. But, in terms of its essential purpose and objective, the attack on the right to abortion is not aimed at trans people. The essence of what is involved is not inclusion, or the lack of inclusion. Nor is this about bodily autonomy, in some general and abstract sense, a concept which, by the way, would logically include people coming from a very bad place, such as those anti-scientific lunatics and selfish individualists who refuse to get vaccinated against COVID. The attack on the right to abortion is a move to further intensify the already horrific oppression of women, denying them control of their lives and their very bodies, reducing them to breeders of children, cruelly subordinated to men in a patriarchal male supremacist society. Forced motherhood is in fact female enslavement. Anything which waters down or distracts from this essential truth is objectively aiding this fundamental attack on the half of humanity that is female, is undermining the fight for their emancipation and the emancipation of humanity as a whole from any form of oppression and exploitation.
All right, once again, that was a piece from Bob Avakian, and it was read by one of the members of the Revolution Club. Now, I am very happy to be welcoming back to the show somebody who seems to come really a lot, especially when I'm literally looking for something that I really want to talk to her about. She pops up, and there she is. Sansara Taylor, welcome to the show.
Michael, it's really good to be with you. Thank you.
Sure. And what I want to do, what I'm really, I know you know what we're going to talk about, but I'm really, you know, I really want to sort of dig into this, because this whole question of what's happening, you know, we're talking about women, we're talking about all this, but people really need to understand the depth of this. They need to understand both, just see what's, it's not enough to just see what's on the top, but people have to actually think about, you know, what is this? Where is it coming from? What difference does it make if we're in this society? So what I'm going to do is ask you a number of questions, and then we can just go off of that, if that's cool with you.
Sounds excellent.
Okay. First, March 8th, International Women's Day, is coming up in a few weeks. Rise Up for Abortion Rights has issued a call for protests everywhere. Tell us what Rise Up for Abortion Rights is, and tell us about that call.
Yes, so as you said, March 8th, every year, this is International Women's Day. This is a day for people to stand up worldwide against the enslavement and the degradation, the mistreatment, the violence against women, the degradation, the humiliation, all of the ways this takes shape, including much of what your last guest, Robert, was speaking about. But this year, International Women's Day comes at a time when the leading edge that really concentrates the whole of whether women are going to be enslaved or women are going to be emancipated is a frontal, all-out assault on women's fundamental right to abortion, to decide for themselves when and whether to have a child. The Supreme Court, people need to know this. A lot of people have heard about, not enough people, frankly, but a lot of people have heard about the abortion ban in Texas, banning nearly all abortions, almost entirely for all women of childbearing age in Texas since September of last year, and this is outrageous. But in addition to that, the Supreme Court is considering right now a case out of Mississippi that is a 15-week abortion ban that, if upheld, would either gut or completely overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark decision that first established abortion rights nationwide. And when they heard this case last December, the fascist majority of judges, including Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, Trump's appointees, but also others, made clear that they were very inclined and poised to uphold this Mississippi ban. So right now we're sitting and we're expecting a ruling sometime in late spring or early summer at the latest. So we are sitting here at a moment when there's a ticking time bomb of outright female enslavement. Control over women's bodies, their reproduction, their lives, their destinies is set to go off. And so this International Women's Day, Rise Up for Abortion Rights, which is a new movement, I'll answer that part of the question in a moment, is calling on people across this country, exactly like you said, to take to the streets, to raise bloody hell, to say that we refuse to go back to the days when women were dying in the back alleys from unsafe, botched, illegal abortions, when women were forced to have children against their will and have their lives, their dreams, their whole existence foreclosed and forced into motherhood against their will, which is a form of enslavement. It's a form of violent control by the state over women's very bodies and being and life course. And it is every bit as violent and an assertion of patriarchal control as rape is. And this is a form of enslavement, and it is coming. It's on track. This anti-abortion movement has been building for decades. Right now they have a majority in the Supreme Court. They have state legislatures passing laws all across this country restricting abortion. If Roe v. Wade falls, more than 20 states in this country will immediately ban entirely or severely restrict abortion rights. 41% of women of childbearing age in this country will lose the nearest abortion clinic, and then it will go further from there if this juggernaut of female enslavement, anti-abortion fanaticism is not stopped. And so this March 8th, again, we're calling on people nationwide to take to the streets to say, we refuse to let the Supreme Court deny women's humanity and decimate their rights. We are standing up for abortion on demand and without apology, nationwide, in the streets, International Women's Day, March 8th. And that is not a one-off. Then we go forward from there. We stay in the streets. We gather more people, more fury, more momentum. We create a political situation through our struggle from below where the Supreme Court doesn't feel they can get away with taking this right away. And we've got a very, very huge challenge in front of us, a very, very ugly thing that is coming. And there's a limited amount of time to stop it. And this is what we're calling on people to wake up now before it is too late. There is plenty of time to stop it if we act. There really is, but not if we sit back. And so that's our big challenge to people. If you do not choose to stand up and go in the streets to fight against forced motherhood, then you are actively choosing to let women be enslaved.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very heavy because as I'm sitting here, I know we've talked about things like this I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm, what, 150 years old right now? So, you know.
I thought you were 15.
Yeah, that's a
you
I tried.
Act
yeah.
Like it.
Yeah, there you go. And that's going to be, that's going to stay that way until they drag me out. Okay. Anyway, one of the things I really wanted to talk with you about, and you began to hit at this. I mean, we're talking about the rise up for abortion rights in this show. We've done several times, but people don't actually know the organization, why it was formed. You began to speak to some of this, but there's actually, you know, one of the things that really made my heart happy was that there was that when I was reading about this, there were many people that, you know, I didn't look at before as being basically drawn into this. I think there's a big change in a certain sense, not complete, but there's something that's really speaking to people, especially women. But I think, you know, a lot of men are beginning to start look out this way too. And there's a fight around this. I think there's going to be a fight around this about what do you do? What do you do with women in the way they act in the whole basically place where people live and where they you know all the good things are, you know. And I think there's a lot that we could talk about here. And I'd like you to really give people a sense of, you know, this you know, some of the stuff, some of what's going on, and then talk a little bit about, okay, what has been done too. You know, what have folks been doing in terms of bringing out this whole thing about abortion rights and why it's so important and what people should be doing about it, what they can be doing about it?
Yeah, so the movement riseupforabortionrights.org, which people can find and should go to the website, riseup4abortionrights.org. This is a new movement. We formed just in early or mid-January. And I initiated it together with others from different political perspectives. As you know, Michael, and as many listeners hopefully do know, I am a follower of the revolutionary leader, Bob Avakian. He's the architect of the new communism, and I'm a fighter for a revolution. I believe the whole system that we live under, capitalism, imperialism, is rotten to its foundations. I mean, it has white supremacy baked into it. It has male supremacy and patriarchy baked into it. It's destroying the planet. It's causing wars and devastation around the world, and it's treating human beings who are driven from their homelands from climate change and war and imperialist domination as refugees and aliens, and locking them up, demonizing them, putting them in concentration camps, including in this country, this anti-immigrant hysteria. So I'm against this entire system, and I am convinced, based on the scientific leadership Bob Avakian has provided, that we're in a rare time when revolution is not only necessary, but it's possible. And Bob Avakian has formed written a constitution, a whole vision and concrete plan for how we'd run a new society that uproots all this oppression and inequality, all the exploitation, a whole different way that humanity could live. So I'm in this fighting for human emancipation, and I'm calling on everybody to join in that. Get with the RevComs and raise good hell to bring about a real revolution in this rare time. But I'm also in this movement, Rise Up for Abortion Rights, uniting with people who come at this question of the abortion emergency from very different perspectives. People who aren't fighting for revolution, who think capitalism is a fine system, who want to restore what they see as the democracy that should be in this country. They're people from very different perspectives who recognize, as I do, because it's reality, that if we don't act on an emergency footing, women will lose their fundamental legal standing as full human beings. And that will be a hell on earth for the half of humanity that is female, and it'll be a nightmare for society as a whole, and we've got to fight it. So we formed this group, again, riseupforabortionrights.org. It brings together people from very different perspectives, from the writer and activist Ruchira Gupta to an abortion provider who has been doing abortions at her clinic for 50 years, longer than Roe v. Wade. She opened one of the first abortion clinics in the country, Merle Hoffman, out in New York in Queens. Susan Brown Miller, the longtime second-wave feminist author, many people know her, Gloria Steinem. V, who is formerly Eve Ensler, the artist and activist, Layla Hathaway. The young gymnast, Morgan Hurd, who's been an Olympian medalist many times over, the whole Cornell West, a whole host of people from different perspectives came together and initiated this movement that really is calling on people to get out of their comfort zone, to answer the challenge of this moment, and looking at the reality that if we don't act, we're going along with women's enslavement. But conversely, if people stand up, look, the Supreme Court is a political institution. then take a read on what the population is willing to accept. And there have been, law professors. There was somebody who quoted in a very insightful article in the New York Times, a law professor named Kate Shaw, who said, in a certain sense, I'm paraphrasing, but in a certain sense, the Supreme Court kind of dipped their toe in the waters when they let stand the Texas near total abortion ban. And they said there wasn't that much public outcry. So she's speculating that they're calculating that there won't be that much outcry if they overturn Roe v. Wade nationwide, because they essentially did it in Texas. And I think that's a very insightful comment. They are watching. They got away with this in Texas. There was little outcry. If there were to be outcry, if people were to fill the streets, if people were to wake up and come out in our massive numbers, if the fury of women was unleashed and rocked this society, flooded the streets, students walking out of campuses, shutting it down, people speaking in the arts and the sciences, people putting it on the line to say we won't let women be enslaved, that could change what the Supreme Court and what Christian fascists and women haters everywhere feel they can get away with. It is absolutely possible to beat this attack back, but we have to get out and we have to fight for it. So we formed this on an emergency footing, this movement, Rise Up for AbortionRights.org. And in Los Angeles, I want to speak very directly to people across the country listening, but also in Los Angeles listening, same thing applies. If there's not a chapter in your area of Rise Up for Abortion Rights, and there's not yet one in Los Angeles, we're calling on you, if you care about this issue, if you remember the dark days of back alley deaths and foreclosed lives before Roe v. Wade, or if you're young and you are terrified of what it means that these rights could be lost, or if you're looking at Texas and thinking, I cannot sit still and let this be done to women in that state and other pregnant people, I'm calling on you to get in touch with the Rise Up for Abortion Rights movement today and become part of forming a chapter where you are, become part of organizing where you are, become part of spreading the word. But really calling on everybody to get involved from different political perspectives, stand up, and if you've never done it before, well, we've never faced this emergency before. It's going to require people doing things they've never done before. That's what you do. It's the order of the day. Get involved and get involved with others, and you can learn how to do it together. And we do have a national office, a national leadership that's in formation as well, but people who are there to help answer questions and help you navigate if this is new. We have fact sheets on our website. We have resources on our website.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm speaking with Sansara Taylor about Rise Up for Abortion Rights, the ticking time bomb threatening abortion rights, and the need to raise hell to protect the woman's fundamental right to abortion. All right, Sansara, I know we're running up on our edge here, and I think it's really important what you've been saying, and the whole question of actually, so much we could talk about more, and because it's just there, but because it's such an important part of what's happening in the world today, and the fact that, basically Democrats and so-called pro-choice movements are trying to erase from the conversation all kinds of any talk about, basically pro-choice movements and what they're doing, and let's not push it too hard. And that one word is another word is abortion, and the other incredibly is women, as you've been pointing out. I want to talk a little bit about that, but also I'm really torn here because I'm going to shut up because it's contradicting us. But, there is also a thing that people have to realize that in Nazi Germany, Hitler and an official office called the Central Office for the Combating of Homosexuality and Abortion. This is part of a fascist program, sisters and brothers. This is part of a fascist program. And if you look at one of these anti-abortion, anti-women marchers, they are full of fascist thugs. Let's talk about that a little, too, because that's something that I think goes along with what I was just mentioning as well.
Well, I think, there's, I think, two different questions in what you said that I want to touch on. One is that the Christian fascist movement is a core of the fascist forces in this country. The armed insurrection at the Capitol last January 6th was, you saw if you were watching it, the huge crosses the religious symbolism. You saw the Proud Boys kneeling down in prayer before they charged into and broke into the Capitol. You saw, and this is linked to, over years, the building up of shock troops, Christian fascist, fanatical, blindly obedient, women-hating fanatics. And they've terrorized abortion providers. They've killed abortion doctors. They've harassed women. There are millions and millions. This is a big part of the social base, not only of the anti-abortion movement, but of the all-around fascism in this country. So, you know, I think Rosanna Arquette, who's one of the signers of Rise Up for Abortion Rights, she put it that the road to fascism in this country runs right through the wombs of women, right through the bodies of women, right through the control over women. And this is a very close link, patriarchal control and degradation of women and overall fascism. So this is one connection that I think is very important. And we have to go up against that just for women's lives and if you don't want a fascist America. For both those reasons, we have to join this fight. Again, it's riseupforabortionrights.org and March 8th in the streets. The other part of what you're saying is that I think is very important is that there has been a widespread capitulation by the mainstream of the so-called women's movement and the so-called leaders of the so-called women's movement, where they are almost universally preparing for a post-Roe America, preparing for after abortion rights fall nationally, rather than calling people into the streets now to fight to preserve these rights. And that is exactly the dynamic that we saw in the rise of Nazi Germany, where over and over again, there'd be a new restriction on Jewish life, and people would adjust and learn to live within it. And then there'd be a new restriction, expelling all the Jewish academics from the university. People would adjust and find new jobs. Then they would be expelled from certain neighborhoods and homes. They'd adjust and find new ways to live within it. And I'm talking both about the Jewish communities in their large numbers and in some of their leadership, as well as the broader society that sat and said, well, it's not me, until it was too late. And this is the same dynamic you see with the mainstream women's movement right now, so-called, adjusting to each new attack on abortion, even though it's very clear that behind it is another and behind it is another, and this anti-abortion movement won't stop until women are literally enslaved. So the time to stand up and change that dynamic is now, and we are going to be the ones who have to do it. This is what Rise Up for Abortion Rights .org. That's why we formed. That's why we're calling people into the streets March 8th, International Women's Day, and nationwide after that. And going into that, we have to go and wake people up, shock them into being awake, into coming out on March 8th. People got to be out there doing street theater, being in people's spaces, challenging them, getting the flyers and the posters out everywhere, getting on social media. Everybody who cares has a way to contribute. You can go to the website, riseup4abortionrights.org, or write to info@riseupforabortionrights.org.
All right, Sansara Taylor, as usual, I'm really glad you were here, and I think it's been a really important conversation. So don't stay away. Let's get you back real soon. Okay?
It's really great. It's always great. Okay. It's always great to talk to you, man.
All right, take care. All right, thank you. Thank you very much. All right, this is the Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Sansara Taylor about March 8th and Rise Up for Abortion Rights.
We have some time left, so I'm going to play a clip from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the author of The New Communism. This is from the talk BA Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. And it's about the patriarchal oppression of women, rape, abortion, pornography, and the female enslavement. So check this out.
And along with this, women are subjected to continual assaults on their right to abortion and even birth control. Don't let these people tell you, these so-called right-to-lifers, that the issue is the killing of innocent babies. The issue is the control over women exercised by forcing them to be mothers, whether or not they want to be at that time. Now, to have children, to raise children, can be a really beautiful experience if that's what you want to do and if you feel in a position to do it in the way that you feel that it should be done. But to have it forced on you is virtual enslavement. Not to even have the choice as to whether you will do that. And here's the key to how you know, or one key to how you know this is not about killing of innocent babies. Try to find one of these rabid anti-abortion groups that is also not opposed to birth control. You'll have a very hard time. They're all opposed to birth control because the issue is not the killing of innocent babies. It's the control and subordination of women who are regarded as getting all out of hand these days in this society, which is another reason why we have, or a contributing factor to why we have this vicious pornography. So the goal of these attacks on abortion and, yes, on birth control, the right to them, is to deny women the ability to determine something as basic as when or if they will have children and raise children or be part of raising them, forcing motherhood on them once again and enslaving them in that way. Along with all this, millions of women and girls, millions every year in this country alone, are raped, assaulted, battered, and abused, often by those who claim to be their intimate lovers, while the half of humanity that is female is everywhere treated as less than fully human. Once again, I think about the experience of black people in slavery. You know what one of the main terms the slave owners used to describe the slaves? Talking tools. Because this is how they regarded them, and this is how they were treated. They were put on the auction block to be sold, and their physical attributes were examined. Their teeth, if they were women, their reproductive potential, their body shapes, their ability to work hard, their musculature. All this was examined in the most degrading way. And you think of the same thing with women today, reduced to objects to be used by men, treated as brood animals to turn out babies, and as unthinking flesh to be consumed and plundered, with their bodies and body parts used to sell products, pimped out and beaten into submission, plundered to portray and promote sex as conquest and domination by men instead of shared pleasure based on mutual affection and equality. All of this degrades and demeans not only the women who are directly subjected to the most extreme forms of this, but all women everywhere. What kind of system is this? And why should anyone accept that this is the best possible way the world could be? And those whose sexual orientation is different from and seen as posing a threat to the dominant gender and sex relations, lesbians and gays, bisexual and transgendered people, or those who are simply unsure about their sexuality and questioning it at a given time, are harassed, bullied, often bullied to the point of committing suicide, brutalized and even murdered. And despite certain changes in law and government policy, the reality of LGBT people being discriminated against, insulted, and even assaulted continues as a marked feature of the culture and society, bound up with deep-seated structural relations of this whole system, closely connected to the patriarchy and male supremacy that oppress women.
All right, that was Bob Avakian from the speech BA Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less. You can find the entire talk at revcom.us. In fact, you can find a whole lot of stuff from BA, the Revolution Club, and others on how to make an actual revolution and why we are living at a time when revolution may actually be possible. So go there. All right, now I want to thank all of my guests today, Robert Jensen and Sansara Taylor. And I'd like to thank the people who worked on the show, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and Gary Baca, who's, yeah, it's just a joy to see Gary's face over there, all right? And if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out with Garbage, No Gods, No Masters. Talk to you again next week.